but they don't see any way out, any light at the end of the tunnel for these people.
The continuing saga of a Vietnamese family and the U.S. entry ban. It's Tuesday, February 7th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us now on VOA Asia Facebook to get a bigger program experience. Also ahead, the U.S. Defense Secretary makes his final stop in Asia. History says 2017 may not be a good year for Trump and China. A call to end FGM. Indian women are wrestling. We hit the mat right now with today's VOA Asia. An executive order U.S. President Donald Trump signed on January 27th halted the entry for all refugees for 120 days for a review of the U.S. refugee admissions program. It also barred all Syrian refugees indefinitely and set a 90-day entry ban on immigration from seven Muslim-majority countries. A Vietnamese monk that we'll call H because of safety concerns, his wife and two children, obtained refugee status in 2014. They were scheduled to fly to the United States when the executive order took effect, blocking their scheduled journey. VOA Asia's Steve Miller spoke with Nguyen Tin Thong, president and CEO of Boat People, SOS, the organization helping H and his family reach the United States. Steve asked Tong how U.S. Judge James Robart's decision in Washington state to block President Trump's executive order has affected H's attempt to enter the United States.
Just today, IOM notified them that their flight has been rescheduled for the 15th of February, and they are going to report to the IDC later today.
The IDC is a detention center where refugees like H and his family have to stay before they begin transit to the United States. H and his family had already paid $190 and were prepared to enter the facility before the travel restrictions were implemented. Now, Tong, do they have to pay this $190 fee once more?
Exactly.
How much of a financial hardship is this for them?
Oh, very much. Actually, they didn't have the $190 in the first place, so we had to raise money among friends in the U.S. to help them pay for that. And what it means is that now we have to take care of that portion again.
And what are they most concerned about? I mean, aside from the wife being 6 months pregnant, there's a concern about whether or not she'll be medically fit for flight. What else are they concerned about?
What they are concerned about now is that if, because there's a battle in court right now, back and forth, if somehow the suspension of a ban was reversed, that would put them in truly a bind because they would already be in IDC. And once in IDC, even though their departure day would be removed, would be moved indefinitely into the future, they might not be released from that detention. Because once in the detention, you may not be able to get out. What would mean, yeah, is that children, young children, a pregnant woman, and a former monk would be spending indefinite time in detention.
What are your biggest concerns, not only with H and his family, but with refugees and asylum seekers in general?
We are concerned on two counts. One is that the direct impact on refugees. Many of these refugees actually have been persecuted in their own countries because of their belief, because of the values that they abide by, that they protect and defend. And those values are the same values shared by Americans: freedom of religion, freedom of faith, freedom of expression. Secondly, at the border, on a border level, we are afraid that the travel ban, if implemented indiscriminately, it might have ramifications in different countries. For instance, if Thailand sees that recognized refugees are not leaving the country, they may become harsher in treating these asylum seekers and refugees. The UNHCR might feel compelled to reject the status of refugee status to a lot more people, but they don't see any way out, any light at the end of the tunnel for these people. they would be under pressure from the Thai government not to recognize as many refugees as before.
Nguyen Dinh Thong, President and CEO of Boat People SOS, speaking with VOA Asia's Steve Miller. There's much more on our top story on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. World Health Organization medical experts warn of rising health costs in Asia. Afghan diplomat killed by his guard in Pakistan. South Korea feeling pressure to appease Trump on trade. Maryland church heartbroken for refugee family caught in Trump ban. World's longest flight touches down in New Zealand. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, check out our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis appears to have assured Asian allies, South Korea and Japan, of the Trump administration's continued security commitments. At his final stop in Tokyo on his first foreign trip, Mattis told his Japanese counterpart, America stands by its long-standing defense treaty with Tokyo and its control over East China Sea islands contested by China.
Today, the minister and I discussed the security situation, and I made clear that our long-standing policy on the Senkaku Islands stands. The United States will continue to recognize Japanese administration of the islands, and as such, Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty applies. As the Japanese people know so well, jointly we face many security challenges in this region, from the threat of nuclear and missile provocations by North Korea to increasingly confrontational behavior by China in the East and South China Seas, we recognize the changing security situation. In our meeting together, Minister Inada and I confirmed our intention to continue close coordination on these and other security issues.
Mattis praised Japan's increased defense spending and its financial support for U.S. forces in the country. University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Mattis also appeared to be successful in convincing South Korea it intends to deploy an anti-missile system amid North Korea's continued missile and nuclear tests.
Comments made by then-President-elect Donald Trump raised some questions about whether South Korea and Japan were doing enough for the alliance. There's been domestic turmoil inside South Korea due to the impeachment trial of the president. And, of course, Prime Minister Abe has been very keen to get a reading on President Trump. So Secretary Mattis, I mean, it's the first, his first overseas visit. It's the first visit by a cabinet member of the Trump administration. And it's music to their ears. I mean, he reassured South Korea and the theater high-altitude area defense will probably be deployed to protect against ballistic missiles, most likely in this year. And particularly with Japan, the reassurance of a new administration about the Senkaku Islands, that the commitments made under the Mutual Defense Treaty that President Obama had made are now reasserted.
China's reaction was quite strong about the U.S. anti-missile shield being deployed in South Korea and or the issue of the Senkakus. We urge the U.S. side to take a responsible attitude, stop making wrong remarks on the issue involving those islands and sovereignty, avoid making the issue more complicated and bringing instability to the situation.
Yes, well, I think we can expect that kind of comments from China. One, it's we'll be pressured by the Trump administration and Secretary Mattis to do more to get Korea to cease these ballistic tests. Some 20 last year, two nuclear explosions, and now threats to soon develop an intercontinental ballistic missile and fire it. With Japan, it's a sovereignty question, a dispute between the two from Chinese perspective. They've got to say that to keep themselves in the game. But Japan is not in a strong position without American backing, and that it's got, and that will make China's task more difficult.
Mr. Mattis also said that there's no need for a dramatic U.S. military move in the South China Sea at this time. We don't see any need for dramatic military moves at all.
He testified the day after the nominee for the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, was much more nuanced, suggested law, diplomacy would have to come into it, allies as well. And so the affirmation that he gave in Tokyo, one should be reassuring, in other words, keeping stability in the region on the South China Sea, and stressing diplomacy is left open and some tough bargaining between Washington and Beijing on the larger question of regional order and the management of their relationships.
Meanwhile, the former head of the Australian Defence Force, Sir Angus Houston, says while it's too late to stop China's island militarization effort in the South China Sea, he said the focus should be on freedom of navigation and the right of innocent passage. Happening now in Asia, U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis said the disputed Senkaku Islands, also claimed by China as the Diaoyus, are covered by a U.S.-Japan defense treaty. China sent Coast Guard vessels into the East China Sea and accused Washington of stirring up trouble. This story and more is on Steve Miller's Asia in a Minute, daily on VOA Asia Facebook. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. From trade to the One China policy to the South China Sea, some tense words have been exchanged between Beijing and Washington recently. VOA Mandarin reporter Li Ya joins us to explain why 2017 may not be the best year for President Trump to try pushing hard against China.
I think right now they really don't know what to make of President Trump. As you just mentioned, what made them really nervous is his questioning of the One China policy, which, you know, is really the cornerstone, the foundation of the U.S.-China relations. So I think Beijing right now is pretty anxious about what kind of China policy the Trump administration might adopt. And I'm sure they're watching very carefully what's going to come up next.
You had spoken with some experts about the Trump-China relationship, and they had indicated that 2017 might not be the best year for Donald Trump to provoke China. What are some of the things that the experts were talking about specific to this year?
Domestically for China, the 19th Party Congress is going to be held this fall. This thing happens every 5 years, and it's a major thing for the Chinese President Xi Jinping. So this year is especially important. Right now we have 7 Politburo members. 5 of them are expected to retire from that. So you can see that's a major turnover. And so a lot of power struggle is involved in that. And not only the standing member of the Politburo, there's also the Central Committee members. And a lot of them are also going to be retired, or they have to leave those posts. Richard McGregor, he used to be the bureau chief for the Financial Times. He also served as the bureau chief for the Financial Times here in Washington, D.C. He basically said that, you know, at this very sensitive time for China, it's not really a good time. The experts are pointing out that when you have a major party congress going on, the government is extremely sensitive to any external pressures.
China has a selection year, not an election year, but I do believe things are much more sensitive, and you can get a very good idea of that from looking at what happened in 2012 between Japan and China when they had their last fight over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, and really the bilateral relationship has never recovered since. I mean, there's another dynamic happening there. But this is the absolute worst time to dump a sensitive issue into the internal politics in Beijing.
Like Richard McGregor put it, you know, he cited the China-Japan relations in last party congress in 2012. We had the Diaoyu Island dispute. China-Japan relations, even today, hasn't really recovered from that. So the same thing it could be true between China and the United States if President Trump takes some steps, whether it's on the One China policy or in the South China Sea. The Chinese government has no choice but to react very strongly. So they think this is a particularly dangerous time for the U.S. administration to do anything that's harmful to the U.S.-China relations.
Li Ya from our Mandarin service, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Beijing plans to cut coal use by 30% in 2017 to help tackle the city's air pollution problem. Six districts will attempt to reach zero coal use and eliminate small coal-fired boilers. Beijing also plans to take 300,000 obsolete cars off the road, raise fuel standards, and promote greener cars. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Leading United Nations and humanitarian organizations are calling for an end to FGM, or female genital mutilation, a traditional practice that causes physical harm and extreme emotional trauma to tens of millions of girls and women, some in Asia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Nearly 200 million girls and women are living with the harmful, traumatic consequences of female genital mutilation. And the United Nations reports an additional 3 million girls, most under the age of 15, continue to be mutilated every year. UN agencies report half of all women and girls have been cut in three countries, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Indonesia. They add the highest prevalence of FGM among girls ages 14 and under is found in Gambia, Mauritania, and Indonesia. Adebisi Adebayo is program advisor to the UN Inter-African Committee on Traditional Practices. She tells VOA that FGM, which has no formal basis in religion, persists because of social and cultural pressure.
In some communities, it's a requirement for girls to pass into womanhood. It is a requirement for them to be eligible for marriage. And that is when you find an adult lady willingly submitting herself to be cut.
Female genital mutilation involves the partial or total removal of the external female genitalia for non-medical reasons. It is usually carried out by women circumcisers. In many places, however, FGM is carried out by health professionals, a practice the World Health Organization calls unethical. The United Nations says some progress is being made toward abolishing FGM. It reports that nearly 3,000 communities, where the UN Population Fund and UN Children's Fund work, have declared they are abandoning this practice. It says more progress must be made to reach the UN's sustainable development goal of ending female genital mutilation by 2030. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Developing at this hour in Asia, the World Health Organization says cancer treated in late stages results in 1.3 million deaths a year in Southeast Asia. It says Asia faces a growing burden in treatment costs due to rising numbers of diagnosed cancer patients. China's national bill set to increase fourfold by 2025. You'll get all the information on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, in the northern Indian state of Haryana, an increasing number of young women are taking to wrestling, a sport not traditionally open to them. Anjana Pasricha reports how wrestling is helping to change conservative attitudes toward women after many scored successes in international contests.
On a chilly winter morning, a group of young girls and women do warm-up exercises ahead of a grueling three-hour training session at the Chotu Ram Stadium in Rohtak town in India's northern Haryana state. 12-year-old Meenakshi begins practice at 6 a.m. before she heads to school. Like the other women and girls, her inspiration is female wrestler Sakshi Malik, who trained at this stadium and shot to national fame after bagging a bronze medal at the 2016 Olympic Games.
Only 9 seconds she made her life wonderful, completed.
Wrestling for women was frowned upon in the conservative state that is known for its male-dominated village councils and sex-selective abortions. But a slow change began after two women made their mark as world-class wrestlers at the 2010 Commonwealth Games. When Coach Mandeep came to the stadium 6 years ago, only a handful of girls learned wrestling. Now he is inundated with questions as scores of parents have overcome traditional taboos and wrestling has become a rage.
Earlier, parents stopped the girls and kept them at home because that was the social norm. Now parents are supporting them and fulfilling their ambitions. It's a huge social change.
Many of them, like 17-year-old Tina Malik, who has bagged a national medal, have come from villages where women are often covered from head to toe and where girls could not mix with boys.
Earlier, even for practice, we could not wear clothes like this. Now we can wear this sports gear. No one objects.
It is not just the attire that is liberating. Dreams are getting fired as they emerge from the shadows of tradition to pack power and punch in a bout of wrestling. Pinky Malik, the daughter of a farmer, has already won a gold medal at the 2016 Commonwealth Championship and is determined to emerge on top in the next Olympics. But medals are not the only achievement.
Women should get respect. That's the biggest issue, respect. Wrestling will improve things for us.
As their success changes traditional attitudes, wrestling has become the unlikely path helping Haryana's young girls and women break barriers and write their own future. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Rohtak, Haryana.
And as our VOA Asia program draws to a close, you can follow us all day long on Facebook at VOA Asia. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus, our managing editor is Diane Gao, and a special thanks to our VOA Asia team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, Eli Zimmerman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Joaquin Archivaldo Guzman Loera, known by various aliases, including El Chapo, 59, arrived in the United States on January 19th, following his extradition from Mexico. He was arraigned the following day on a 17-count superseding indictment before U.S. Magistrate Judge James Orenstein in federal court in Brooklyn. Following his extradition to the United States on related charges filed in the Western District of Texas and Southern District of California, the Mexican government approved a request by the United States to proceed with prosecution on the charges filed in the Eastern District of New York on May 11, 2016. The indictment alleges that between January 1989 and December 2014, Guzman Loera led a continuing criminal enterprise responsible for importing into the United States and distributing massive amounts of illegal narcotics and conspiring to murder persons who posed a threat to Guzman Loera's narcotics enterprise. Guzman Loera is also charged with using firearms in relation to his drug trafficking and money laundering relating to the bulk smuggling from the United States to Mexico of more than $14 billion in cash proceeds from narcotics sales throughout the United States. As part of this investigation, nearly 200,000 kilograms of cocaine linked to the Sinaloa cartel have been seized. The indictment seeks forfeiture of more than $14 billion in drug proceeds and illicit profits. This extradition is a tremendous victory for the citizens of Mexico and of the United States, said DEA Acting Administrator Rosenberg. Two principles stand out. No one is above the law, and we simply do not quit in the pursuit of justice.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.